How's everyone doing today? Great. You guys enjoy the keynote? Free stuff is good, right? Surface RT, Windows Phone. I'm envious. I can't get mine for a little bit. So my name is Will Chumi. I'm a principal user experience advisor as part of Microsoft's Developer Platform Evangelist Group, and I'm here to talk to you about the principles of Microsoft design. But you know, this talk could just as easily be titled "Why I Came to Microsoft." So I've been at Microsoft for about 6 years. And I want to tell you some of the things that got me really excited about joining the organization. And then I want to walk you through the specifics of the design principles that are embodied in Windows 8. So to begin with, Microsoft made this enormous strategic investment in design beginning in 2003. And the first result of this investment was Office 2007. So I saw Jensen Harris speak at Bakai in December of 2005. And based on the rigor and the approach and the level of just incredible user experience thinking that went into the redesign, it got me totally enamored with the idea that Microsoft was actually this incredible design company. And it was something that, you know, living in the Bay Area was maybe not something that we were necessarily as exposed to. The result of this bet was that Office 2007 became the most critically acclaimed, fastest-selling version of Office ever, at least until 2010 came out. So there's something that's really important to think about. This was an enormous bet for Microsoft. The bet on design in Microsoft was $20 billion a year. How many people work in an organization where they can say that they make a $20 billion a year bet on design? There are almost no organizations out there. It's tremendously exciting. So the next big phase in Microsoft's journey through design was the relaunch of our mobile platform with Windows Phone 7. And we created this brand new user experience that had this really beautiful way of interacting with the content on this, you know, most personal devices. And it enabled these totally rich, immersive experiences that were unlike anything else that you saw on other competing platforms. Really tremendous stuff. I won't read you all of these quotes, but I do want to point out two, in particular the Gizmodo quote and the All Things Digital, right? The next Windows phone is pretty great. It's almost like the phone is happy to be alive, which kind of makes you feel happy to use it. And then All Things Digital. The OS is a mix of elegance and whimsy. It's a treat to use. Mango is sprinkled with delightful animations on nearly every screen. There are some themes here that I want you to think about as we dig into some of what we're going to talk about for Windows 8. And of course, we just launched Windows Phone 8. You guys are going to get to play with it very shortly. So last year, in December of 2011, we launched the same design language on top of Xbox. And we actually just launched an update to this as well. And so the thing to think about is, with all of these different updates, Microsoft is the only organization with a single consistent design language across all the screens that we touch. Microsoft design everywhere. So I started out life in a brand strategy firm, and one of the things that was really important was understanding how organizations talk to themselves internally. And so this next slide actually comes out of a training deck that we use within Microsoft. And the reason why I include this is I want you to understand the level of commitment that we have as an organization when we think about design and when we think about these design principles. For Microsoft, these design principles are the exclusive language for our experiences. And we feel that that creates a level of confidence, comfort, and familiarity with our customers, right? We think about this as the fundamental bridge between us and our customers. So, of course, this is the start screen, right? This is my start screen. This is the Windows Store, where you're going to be making lots of money with your applications that you're building. This is an example of one of the apps that's bundled with Windows 8. This is Bing Weather. And the thing that you notice about this is there's no Chrome. It's edge to edge. It's all about content. It's this really beautiful, immersive experience. So I'm going to go through these five principles, but there's one idea that underlies all of them. And I want you to sort of keep this in the back of your mind, because this really is sort of the core principle behind, or the core idea behind Windows 8. And it all comes down to content before Chrome. Right? If ever you have a question about the design process or a design decision that you're making about your application for Windows 8, come back to this principle and it will probably get you the answer that you need. So when we were starting the design process, alrighty then. When we were that is not my slide. Let me grab my laptop out of here. Thank you. Okay, folks. Sorry. Brief change of plans here. Yeah, the micro, please. Does anyone know some good knock-knock jokes in the meantime, while we're switching over here? Okay. I also need that little box because I need to get my slide out. Yeah. A 20 million or a 20 billion? Okay. What? Boeing? Okay. Okay, let's try this one more time. Really, I want to delete everything. Thank you. Okay, here we go. Right back to where we were talking about. Okay, so when we started the design process of Windows 8, as you might guess, we did an enormous amount of research that went into the thinking behind the user experience. And so one of the things that we did was we asked existing Windows users to go ahead and play with the OS and then draw what they remember. We did the same thing with Mac OS users, but this is an example of Windows users. Right? So what did they end up drawing? All they drew was the actual Chrome that's necessary to make the OS work. They didn't actually draw why they were using the computer. No one uses the computer so that they can scroll a window or so that they can move a window around or minimize it or maximize it. You use the computer for the content. So then what we did is we asked a different group of users to play with a prototype of Windows 8. And then after that, we asked them to draw what they remember of it. This is what they drew. It's all content, right? Content, Chrome, content, Chrome. So when you start to think about your design decision, you start to think about the underlying principles behind Windows 8, it's all about trying to get the OS out of the way of the user and let the content, the reason why they're actually using the computer in the first place, to really come through. And so, of course, here's our start screen again. And so when you start thinking about content before Chrome, the edges become really important, right? They're really easy to hit with fingers, right, when you're holding a device. Likewise, they're actually really easy to hit with a mouse and keyboard because of something called Fitt's Law, right? You can't throw the mouse any farther than the corners, any farther than the edges, so you can always get to those system-level controls. So if I swipe in from the right-hand edge, I get my charms bar, I get the clock overlay. Likewise, if I swipe up from the bottom or I make a selection, I get the application bar, right? That sort of edge control ends up being really, really, a really useful way of getting extraneous Chrome out of the way of the user. The other thing about content before Chrome is that it's one of the implications of it is that you want to make sure that layout, or you want to make sure the content that is similar to other content lays out next to each other. Right? You don't want to impose machine-driven limitations on how that content gets consumed by the user. The other thing is, we start to think about all the monitors that are being sold right now. Something like 3/4 of monitors that are sold around the world are either 19x10 or 19x9, or 16x9 rather, excuse me. Right? So let the content flow along the wrong axis. This is an example from the Bing News app, right? I'm somewhere in the middle. But at the same time, we don't want to impose this sort of additional navigational burden on the user. So that's where things like semantic zoom come from. So remember, content before Chrome. So what we're going to do now is we're going to dig into the five principles of Microsoft design. The first is pride and craftsmanship, being fast and fluid, authentically digital, doing more with less, and finally winning as one. So pride and craftsmanship. At the highest level, this is about sweating every detail, right? Every pixel on screen counts. So be really careful about how you lay stuff out. It's also about making sure that the overall experience of your application is safe and reliable, right? Does the application behave properly when it's offline? Does it behave properly when you're working with a slow connection, right? Does it behave properly when you're working on a lower power machine? This last element, alignment to the grid, ends up actually being really important because for a couple of different reasons. So Metro is built on top of a 20 by 20 pixel grid, but that grid gives you this skeleton on which to hang your content. And all of a sudden, you're able to sort of make explicit the hierarchy simply by virtue of placement on this grid. The other thing about this grid is that, you know, Windows lives on a variety of different form factors, right? We run on everything from a device like this, which has a 1366 by 786 screen, all the way up to those big all-in-ones that we saw, or even the Perceptive Pixel device, which have enormous resolutions, you know, north of 2,500 pixels by whatever the other dimension is. If you align to the grid, your application will scale properly, and you won't end up with subpixel rendering of your graphic assets, right? This is not only just about information architecture. This is actually also about how your application behaves on large resolutions. So this is an example of the hub coming out of Visual Studio. This is the Visual Studio hub template. And you can notice that there's this Metro silhouette, right? 120 pixels in from the left. The title is baselined at 100 pixels from the top. Content begins at 140 pixels down. But there's nothing that says that those tiles have to be uniform. In fact, we really encourage you to think about how you can use size, position, and placement of the different tiles on screen as a way to bring different levels of emphasis to your content. If all of these are just one size, and I'm scrolling through all of my content, all of those bits of content have similar weights in the user mind. And it becomes this sort of just sea of visual noise. If you start to play with the placement, if you start to play with the size, you give the users clues about what they want to focus on. Super important. There's nothing that says, though, that aligning to the grid means that everything has to be rectilinear. This is an example app that we built as one of the exercises to help developers and designers think about how they can push their applications. But you'll notice it still lines up with the grid. You can see another example of this in the store right now with an application called Cocktail Flow. But at the same time, we recognize that there are some situations where you're going to want to push that silhouette some. So this is another example that ends up playing with that a little bit. It still aligns to the underlying 20 by 20 pixel grid, but it doesn't necessarily follow the exact margins. That's important. It's definitely within guidance, but do it deliberately. Don't do it just because, I feel like it. So here are some example applications from the store right now. And you'll note that these three here, Wikipedia, All Recipes, and Store, they all have that same baseline. They all have that same left margin. Hulu keeps the same baseline for its logo, but it decided that it wanted to actually give a little more visual emphasis to that image. So it brought in the margins some more. Right? Think about how you want to play with that in your application. So, being fast and fluid. Windows 8 was designed touch first. Now, I need to give you all the usual caveats. That doesn't mean we don't still love mouse and keyboard. Obviously, we do. But when we talk about being touch first, it's kind of like when you listen to certain designers that say, oh, well, you have to design mobile first. It's kind of a philosophy. It's an organizing principle in terms of how you want to lay out information on a page, how you want to think about the kind of key user experience characteristics of your experience. But the first and foremost thing about being touch first means that you have to be instantly responsive. When you end up touching a touch device that doesn't respond to your touch, not to put touch three times in one sentence, it's a dead machine. It feels broken. What's the thing that happens? You immediately start tapping, and then you start hitting, and then you start going, well, what's going on? Right? your application has to be immediately responsive. There's an enormous amount of technical infrastructure that's built into Windows 8 that helps you do that. But as you're thinking about your experiences, you need to be think about how you can immediately show a reaction, right? The other thing about being touch first and being fast and fluid is that it gives you this experience that that ends up being very intuitive and learnable, right? Touch means, in general, that you can go ahead and reverse actions simply by dragging whatever element you're back out, or by taking your finger back off at the appropriate point. It's what gives you these immersive and compelling experiences. So, let's actually see this in action. Hopefully that's the right switch. No, it's not. We're trying to go here. Okay. Gotcha. Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and log into my machine here by tapping on various portions of me and my family. So this is a start screen, right? And to begin with, that responsiveness thing is super, super important. So you're not going to be able to see the movement of my finger, but what you can maybe see is the fact that this is totally stuck to my finger. And it's that level of responsiveness that you really need to have in your application. So what I want to do next is I actually want to walk through a couple of examples of applications that have really started to do some interesting things. There's an enormous number of areas in that you of sort of bits of elegance that you get out of the box simply by virtue of using the built-in controls. We have an animation library that gives you a whole ton of little subtle gestures. So I don't know if you were paying attention as this was loading in, but you saw that there was a gentle fade-in of all that content as it rolls in. That's something you get for free as part of the using the controls in Windows 8. So let's just start scrolling. And all of a sudden that Netflix bar scrolls back up. But there's another element of this that I really love. You see this little arrow right there? Watch this. See how that just turns around nice and smoothly? It's these little elements, these little bits of sort of elegant touch that really give the sense of a really beautifully and well thought out application. There's another example app that I want to show, and that is our own Photos app. So forgive me for showing pictures of my daughter, anyway. So again, this is super responsive. I can go ahead and tap in something, and I get the image. But the thing that I actually think is really cool is I can go ahead and pinch back out to this zoom, or this view. And then I can pinch again, and I can get to this larger view. And I get this really wonderful little ghost effect, right? Really subtle, but gives a really wonderful sense of quality and of elegance to the application experience. Okay. Next principle is authentically digital. So there are some that have said that this is, they're just being goofy. But in my mind, authentically digital is actually maybe the most profound principle to Microsoft design. And at the end of the day, what this really comes down to is thinking deeply about how do you embrace the medium in which your application experience is going to live, right? How do you think about your application being new and modern? How do you think about your application in the context of it being cloud connected, having these bold, vibrant colors, motion? And for me, again, that question of embracing the medium raises issues of what's the role of design? What's the role of designer? Is design inherent, or is it about the surface? And so, there's been a bunch of talk over the course of the last year around the disclosure of Windows 8 about how we use the international style as one of the inspiration points for the design language. And the international style is also called high modernism, and all of that has the genesis of coming out of a school in Germany called Bauhaus. Right? If you think about product design in the 20th century, you think about architecture in the 20th century. Virtually all of it ties directly back to the philosophy and the work that was done at Bauhaus. You really can't overstate its importance. And so when you think about this question of what's the role of the designer, what's the role of design, what's the role of embracing the medium, Bauhaus has an answer for this. The designer should be offered no refuge in the past, but should be equipped for the modern world in its various aspects, artistic, technical, social, economic, spiritual, so that he may function in society not as a decorator, but as a vital participant. I have a degree in art history, and I'm a designer, so this is like double geek for me. So I ask you, if we're really embracing the medium, when we're looking at these icons, what's the value of us knowing that there's light coming in from the upper left-hand corner above that notepad? What's the value of making a calculator app on a computer look like a Casio from the 1970s? Right? Why do I have a Flipboard calendar? Likewise, if I'm looking for content, all of this is Chrome, right? How does this have anything to do with trying to find content on my computer? And it's not like we're the only ones that are doing this. The other guys are just as guilty as well. This is how we do it in Windows 8. What happened to that color? This is how we find content in Windows 8, particularly green content. If we want to go ahead and jump to a particular point in the list, there we go, now we got the gray. I can go ahead and do semantic zoom in order to jump out to a particular point in time. If I want to sort by file name, I can again jump to a particular point in the list using semantic zoom. This is an example of how to think about a mutual fund, right? So I've got mutual funds across the top. Each of the individual gray boxes are individual stocks. So let's say I want to do an instant comparison of relative performance between these different mutual funds. Yeah, I could go ahead and go to a different page. But if I think about this in an authentically digital way, if I think about what are the capabilities that are afforded to me by the platform, I end up with something like this. Instantly understandable right there. Authentically digital is the genesis of live tiles, right? It's the genesis of semantic zoom. It's this way of thinking about how does your content evolve based on the capabilities of the device that it lives on, right? Why should I just have static icons? Why shouldn't I have elements that are presenting new data over time? Or we can just go back to decorating icons. Okay, next point, doing more with less. Windows 8 is designed, so as much as I as a designer want to believe that the experience that I've lovingly crafted is the sole focus of my user's attention when they're going through their daily lives, it's just not true. We live in a low attention span environment. What Windows 8 is trying to do is trying to help our users focus. And we also want to make sure that your applications are really fantastic at a specific thing rather than trying to cover the waterfront. Right? This is all about being focused and direct. It's helping users focus on what really matters. So in this example, you know, yeah, I can say I have my little GIFs that say that this is for navigation, except that if in a Windows 8 world, if each of these are always touch targets, why do I need these GIFs? I don't. They're visual noise. Get rid of them. In Windows 8, when I consume a photo, I'm consuming the content. And when I want to actually do something, then I swipe up from the bottom or down from the top, and I go ahead and get the title and can get the commands. You can see an example of this in the Photo Bucket app or in our own app, our own Photos app. Likewise, if I'm consuming the web, right? I actually have every pixel on screen devoted to the content that I'm interested in. And only when I want to actually change to a different tab or enter in a new URL do I get that. But you get the content out of the way, you really let the user, you get the Chrome out of the way, you really get the user to focus on the content. One of the things we always see, and this is particularly common in some other platforms or on the web, you'll see all these little things on a bunch of different elements that are there for discoverability. Except right now, you can imagine, as you're scrolling past this, this just turns into a huge amount of visual noise, right? And sure, you could solve touch target size, and you could solve margin between the different elements, but at the end of the day, nothing has priority. Get out of it. Show me that when it's actually relevant. When it's selected, right? or when I've made a couple of selections. Winning is one. So Windows 8 is built on a very specific interaction pattern, but we also have a whole slew of different capabilities that are enabled by the platform itself. There's something like 45 separate contracts that enable your application to tie into other applications. And what we really want you to do is to think about how your application combined with the other applications on that user's machine to complete the scenarios that they care about. So let's go ahead and see some examples of that. So Steve Ballmer ended up demonstrating search pretty extensively this morning, so I won't spend too much time on it, but. So you notice that as soon as I start typing, I start getting search results, right? One of the dirty little secrets about the start screen is if you want to search, you don't have to swipe over and hit the search charm. Just start typing. It's magical, and trust me, you'll be hooked. So I can go ahead and say, okay, well, let's look in the store. Let's see the store crash. Let's try a different app. Let's look at Bing Maps. So of course Bing Maps is going to have a view. I could just as easily switch over to news. One of the things that the search charm and that contracts in general, that the charms in general give you as a brand, is the ability to surface your brand in a bunch of other contexts that you wouldn't normally have access to. And over time, the providers for each individual search, for each individual charm, bubble up, right? So in my role in the West region, I end up spending a bunch of time searching through the store. So that's why search is on top for me, right? Likewise, if maybe you're a news junkie, if you're always using search against the news, news will bubble up to the top. But this has an interesting implication when you start thinking about relative level of effort or relative expenditure of effort as you're developing your app. There are going to be a lot of different applications in any given category. And because of the way that the search charm is built, because it's always about putting the user in control, there's going to be direct competition. So you can imagine that if your competitor produces a better search result, they're going to switch over to that, right? You need to think about how your application gets exposed. You need to think about how your search experience, how your charm experience overall really improves the overall experience of the application. So next thing I want to do is I want to talk about share a little bit. And I'm going to use a basic view of share, kind of the social context, and then I want to talk a little bit more in depth about it. So in my family, I'm the cook. I don't tend to work from recipes too much, but if nothing else, I like using them as inspiration. So let's say I've decided that I got really excited about Harvest Pumpkin Tarts. So I can go ahead and swipe in, hit share, and I can hit the People app. And because I have my Facebook account associated with the People app, I can go ahead and post this directly just from here. So I can say, and just like that, it's off and it's on my timeline. And my friends will probably be wondering why I'm posting that, but that aside. The thing that's really magical about share, or about all of the contracts, is that you, as an application designer and developer, you can make the decision, hey, I want to be able to share. But you don't necessarily have to make the decision about what you're going to share to. You can just say, okay, I'm going to share a URL and a chunk of text. And then the OS will say, okay, well, I've got this set of applications that can receive that. The importance of that is, one, it means that you're sharing to the applications that the user that has your app installed actually care about, as opposed to you having to make a decision that, oh, I'm going to support Twitter, I'm going to support Facebook, and I'm going to support, you know, random social network X. The other thing is it gets you out of the OpenAuth dance or the Facebook API dance, where you have to continually maintain the connection to all of those services. All you do is support the share charm, and the OS does the rest. The caching application ends up maintaining its connection to its own API. One of the things that's missing, though, or one of the things that hasn't been really talked about very much yet, is that ultimately the share charm is not just about social sharing. It's really about connecting one application to another application. And one of the things that's just rolled out with GA is a new version of Wikipedia that I think is just awesome. So we're going to go ahead and swipe in and go MSN. And let's go ahead and highlight Storm here. Ah. Alrighty then, let's try something else. Devastation, that works. So I'm going to go ahead and swipe in, and you'll note that I can go ahead and share to Mail, obviously. I can share to Evernote and OneNote. But then Wikipedia's there. The thing that Wikipedia is doing is they are actually taking what's been selected and let me do an instant lookup. And in this case, because devastation is actually an ambiguous term, it's going to ask me to disambiguate it. But I can go ahead and select it. And just like that, I have my definition right there. So the thing that becomes really powerful is all of a sudden Wikipedia became available to any application that is a share source, right? It will listen to any bit of text that comes out. And then I'm able to drop back in and just like that, continue my browsing experience. There are a bunch of other opportunities when you start to think about how to expose share, when you start to think about how to connect yourself via the other contracts and charms in Windows 8. Think about how your application gets embedded in the rest of the user's workflow. Tremendously, tremendously powerful. So these are the five principles of Microsoft design. And what I want to do is I want to wrap things up by asking you to think about something. So Windows 8 is Windows reimagined. And at the end of the day, we've spent an enormous amount of time thinking through how all of these different design principles express themselves through the OS. And we think that they become a really great foundation for applications to build on top of as well. But we're in this sort of funny time. Right? We're right at the very beginning. So what we're really asking of you is as you think about your application in this environment, we're asking you to reimagine your apps. We're asking you to reimagine the type of relationship that you have with your users through Windows 8. Right? How will your apps be reimagined? How will you be authentic to the medium that you live on? Right? This connected mobile device. How can your application become alive? What do your users really need to focus on? How will your applications integrate into the ecosystem? Remember, content before Chrome. It's the key piece to everything. I encourage everyone, as you're going through the process of design, to check out design.windows.com. It gets updated all the time with new content. There are great examples for how you port an iOS application over from a design perspective. There's also windowsuserexperiencetraining.com. We decided that we wanted to make sure that URL was nice and big. This is about 9 hours of training, and this is also being updated over time that lets you dig into a lot more detail. So there are mics around the room. We have time for some questions if anyone wants to get into some topics. Please walk up to the mic. We are webcasting this, so I'll ask you to say your name and then ask your question, please.
I have a question.
Hi.
In this last example that you used, Wikipedia, wouldn't it be more appropriate to Wikipedia be activated with search? Like, and relating to that is there guidance to when to use search versus share or other?
Sure. Sure. So it's a great question. And the question was whether or not, doesn't it make more sense for Wikipedia to support search rather than share? And the answer is Wikipedia actually already supports search. And you're absolutely correct, they should. The reason why they wanted to think about share was because they wanted to go for that integration into other apps. Right? They wanted to think about how can they basically make themselves a source of data that can be looked up anywhere. And the share charm is what really gives you access to that. The other thing that actually Wikipedia did, Wikipedia ended up implementing type to search, right? So rather than having to go explicitly out Here, let me go ahead and switch over to this. Rather than having to go explicitly out to the share charm, or the search charm, rather, excuse me, all they have to do is start typing. All right, so let's say, and just like that, that would be Seattle if I can spell. Thank you. And just like that, you get your result. Type-to-search is one of those things which hasn't been available to third-party developers until the transition from RP to general availability, but it's a tremendously powerful way to make search a much bigger part of your application. You, please.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the complexity in sharing. Was it how complex can you actually get? Like, can you have data models that you're passing between the apps, or is it restricted to like XML content?
So you can pass structured data. So I'm a designer, so I'm kind of talking at the limit of my knowledge. But I know that you can pass structured data, and you can also pass data types. So you can say, I'm passing a URL, I'm passing text, I'm passing a picture, that kind of stuff. The more sort of esoteric the data that you pass, the more you're reliant on the sort of catching application to be able to interpret it properly. There's something else called activation protocols, which I encourage you to look at in MSDN, which allows you to specifically target another app, which may be more appropriate if you're doing something really specific. But we can talk more offline if you'd like. Yeah.
Hey, my name is Lauren. I have a question. I was working recently on an app which is handling URLs.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I did the share, I decided to accept URLs, but also text, because text could be a URL.
Sure.
And I was not super satisfied with the experience, because basically I have no way to know beforehand if it's actually a URL. So I have to try and fail and show an error message to the user. And I was wondering, what would you recommend? Would you recommend to only accept URLs, which is kind of limiting, and that can be for any content, basically? Or would mm-hmm. you rather recommend to try and fail and show an error message?
So not knowing the end-to-end scenario and sort of what you're trying to accomplish, it's a little bit hard to answer that question yeah. super specifically. But my inclination is that you're probably going to have a better result by just accepting URLs.
Right. So maybe I can rephrase my question. I guess that that was a very specific example. But generally speaking, text can be accepted by any application and then can be interpreted, right? Mm-hmm. Would you rather recommend rejecting text and accepting only really targeted specific content that you're actually going to be able to use? Or would you accept just anything and then after that treat it?
It really comes down to what's the scenario you're trying to accomplish. I'd be happy to talk with you more
sure.
Afterwards to try to get a better sense of the scenario. But at the end of the day, the share interactions, the search interactions, are what are called white dismiss surfaces, right? So they're really designed for this sort of quick in and out, and that's part of the reason why any tap outside of it shuts the experience. It's the same way that flyout works. So if you start going down this path of having to do error correction and all that kind of stuff,
yeah.
you're kind of getting away from the design principle behind why that experience exists in the first place. But let's talk some more after
okay.
the event.
Sure.
Please.
Tell more with the Verge.
Sorry. Him.
Tell more with the Verge. What happened to Metro, and how should developers refer to Metro style now?
So first off, Tom, I'm a great fan of your work. I read The Verge, far often than I probably should. So I'm not going to get into the details of why we're not doing that anymore, but what we are calling the applications is Windows 8 Store applications.
How do you refer to Metro Store?
Windows 8 Store applications.
Say Windows 8
Sure you can. Please, you, sir. Thank you for waiting patiently.
Yeah, it may be that you left the detail out for clarity of vision there, but in the slides you showed where what users remembered from Windows 7 was the buttons and sliders, and what they remember from Windows 8, what I saw was they remembered a bunch of buttons. Was what they were actually drawing the content, or were they still just drawing, these are the places I could punch, and that's the same thing I could punch in Windows 7?
They were drawing the actual content. So the prototype that they were playing with was a prototype hub application. So you can imagine each one of those tiles being an image. In fact, if I remember correctly, that's what the test was. So, you know, at the end of the day, those rectangles were the content itself. It was the reason why they were using the application.
And when they drew them, they actually drew content in, so you knew they were remembering content.
No, they didn't go that far, but they, you know, we were asking them to go pretty quickly. Here, please.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
So one of the things which I think tends to get lost in the overview is that we are looking now at a sort of design which is easy to see when you're consuming content. Mm-hmm. However, when you start to shift down to the spectrum of creation, you start to get burdened with a lot of the things you need to do. In fact, Microsoft, you can tell, struggles with this because over in the desktop, where we're looking at doing file management, for example, we see the ribbon where there are these actions or tools up in the ribbon. And you start to ask yourself, are the tools themselves content, or are they really just part of the experience that I need to do and then kind of step out and see more Chrome or have some kind of a different way of explaining what I'm doing now that I'm in the creation mode? Mm-hmm. So how do you reconcile this? You know, this design language, it looks great, works great for content consumption, but on the other end of the spectrum, it seems to have its struggles. And I'm wondering if there's any guidance for that, for us who are trying to ameliorate and kind of reconcile these two views.
Sure. It's a great question. And it's something that requires some real effort to kind of get through. And I think that the sort of first hint at what you see is in the right direction is when you start to look at some of the actual content creation, specifically the sort of painting applications. And so you'll see them, they sort of span the spectrum. On the one hand, you'll have an app like Evernote Sketch, which is really designed for very, very quick annotations of visual data, right? So I'm adding a picture, I'm adding an annotation, something like that. And what Sketch decided to do was they wanted to actually have their app bars pinned open. And the reason why they did that was because their average interaction is something like 30 to 45 seconds, right? It's 3 to 5 actions. And if you then also have to ask the user to swipe up from the bottom or swipe down from the top in order to change pen or change color, you end up making the tool itself unwieldy. On the other end, you look at something like Fresh Paint, or you look at something like Autodesk Sketchbook. In those cases, it's almost all canvas. And only when you go ahead and bring in and start and want to actually change the tool that you're working in, that's when you end up having this sort of more elaborate app bar that allows you to change the tools. So you have to sort of think about what's the context of what you're trying, or what's the goal that you're trying to solve when you're thinking about how you want to lay out those controls. And if like Fresh Paint or like Sketchbook, you expect the user to spend a substantial amount of time working on the particular content, the particular bit of content that they're working on, then it's better to allow them to really focus on it. On the flip side, if you start to think about, you know, oh, well, I just need to be in and out, then maybe having those app bars pinned open is a more appropriate choice. You need to be very careful about pinning open app bars. At the end of the day, they're designed to be transient. They're designed to get out of the user's way. There are scenarios, like what I just talked about, that do make sense to have them open. You, please.
For Snap and Fill View, I was wondering if there's any design rationale between why you can have an app programmatically snap out of Snap View, but you can't programmatically have an app snap into Snap View, because there are certain cases where it'd be really nice to make your app go to the side for the user. Sometimes the gesture isn't super easy.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, the rationale comes down to keeping the user in control, right? So unless you start going down the path of providing a specific visual affordance for, oh, well, this is going to snap, then you end up running the risk of someone taps on it and then they feel totally disoriented because all of a sudden their application goes away. Whereas when you're coming out of Snap, when you're programmatically coming out of Snap, the thinking is that because the user has gone into Snap in the first place and they know their app, tapping a particular element that does require, you know, more real estate than what's available to you in Snap View is going to be an understood action. Okay? You, please.
Hi. My question might be answered by the two sites that you showed earlier, but do you have an interaction design pattern library for, like, Windows 8 kind of paradigm?
Sure. So there's a ton of data at design.windows.com. It's everything from a whole series of articles that go through the different navigation styles, how you do app bars and commanding overall. There's an overall human interface guideline document, which is something like 280 pages. There's a ton of information available to you. There are also Photoshop templates that allow you to be able to mock up your experience quickly. The other thing that's actually really cool to do, if you have the current version of Visual Studio, Visual Studio Ultimate, it actually installs a series of, oh, I guess I can go to sleep. It installs a series of prototyping tools so you can actually prototype your Windows 8 app in PowerPoint. It's a really cool stuff, so I definitely encourage you to play with it.
I need you to turn on your, because I'd like you to go to the MSN site.
Yeah.
Because my question centers around that. Most of your talk is around design for, can you just go to the homepage?
Yeah.
So most of your design is around designing the app. But what about for HTML? I mean, are there any, do we use the same design concepts like that? Or are there any implications, licensing or royalty, if we decided to, you know, as developers, you know, design our site like that?
There's certainly no licensing. And so the thing to remember, though, is you can talk about using HTML5, JavaScript, and CSS as an environment to build a Windows 8 application, or you can talk about it in terms of building a web experience. And certainly, you know, you can already start to see examples of kind of tile-like interfaces starting to show up all over the place. Certainly, we love to see that. We think that that's a validation of our design vision. But there's nothing that you have to worry about from that perspective. Cool. Please.
Hi, Kent Fairbach.
Hi, Kent.
I have a question. As we talk about getting more and more Chrome out of the way, one of the things I've noticed multiple times just in the presentations I've been at today is people not knowing how to interact with the application. You yourself were trying to hide something, right? And you didn't even know, as the creator of it, you didn't even know how to interact with it. So the question is, like, on the discoverability side, it seems like we've traded off this, you know, I call it magic buttons. I just keep doing things until something works right. And, I mean, have you looked at, you know, the frustration level of the average, you know, my mom, my dad user, and what that impact has?
I wouldn't say it's not a matter of not knowing how to. It's more a matter of not having the dexterity to do so on stage. But that aside, we have actually looked at that. And one of the reasons why this talk exists, one of the reasons why people like me exist in the field, is to help our partners follow the patterns that we're establishing. We did an enormous amount of user research that looked at the speed of learnability when patterns are followed consistently versus when patterns are not followed consistently. And what we found is that there's a massive difference. I mean, it's many multiples of difference in terms of those people that if people are consistently following the pattern, it gets learned many multiples faster than if applications are inconsistently following the pattern. That's at the end of the day, the part of the reason why we're spending so much time and effort on design, on launching design.windows.com, on this session of tracks, or on this series of tracks, is to make sure that our partners do follow these patterns so that it is learnable, so that the overall experience is satisfying. Please.
Hi, this is Xiaogun Zhang from Siemens Corporation. I have a question about font size.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that you define the headline font size as 42 points or mm-hmm. you know, whatever font size. The CEO, Steve Ballmer, this morning, he showed an array of devices which ranges up from 88-inch to, you know, mobile phones. And I was just curious, what's the process of you making those decisions, how big the font is? And, you know, I just walked over to the showcase room, and it seems that for the largest display, at least, you know, when you're closing, maybe to a one arm or two arms distance, it looks fine. But when you are at an audience distance, some text doesn't look, you know, quite large enough for the audience to discern. So do you have any mechanism to make the font maybe larger by programmer, and what's your recommendation for that?
So the type ramp in Windows 8 is specific, and while we're very happy to have you use the brand fonts that are associated with your particular brand, we do insist that you follow the type ramp. The type ramp was designed by Sam Moreau's team, and actually if you look at the talk that he gave last year at Build, he goes into a lot of detail about what the different ratios are between the different font sizes and kind of how it got there. In terms of the question of scaling, there are really two basic strategies for how Windows 8 applications work. They either just sort of blow up the experience so that everything gets bigger proportionately, or you end up showing more content. And you can sort of imagine it in terms of the PhotoBucket app, for example. It just shows things bigger because it has high resolution assets that you can pull down and therefore not create a badly scaled image. Whereas if you use the Maps app on a very, very large screen, rather than everything just getting bigger, you just show more content. The specifics of how that works really comes down to the scenario that you're trying to satisfy. Right, if it makes more sense to show more data for the particular use case that your application is trying to solve, then absolutely you should do that. You need to build that into the, or you need to think about that as you're using the layout controls on your hub and on your subsequent screens. Likewise, you can use the viewport to go ahead and do that scaling. If you are going to have bitmap images, you need to make sure that you provide multiple resolutions. Right, so at the build keynote last year, Jensen Harris talked about providing assets at 100%, 140%, 180%. And the reason why we ask you for that is when you do have those bitmap assets and you do go to these very high resolution screens, Windows 8 will automatically pick the appropriate asset for the resolution. And it all just sort of happens automatically. You please.
Do you have any recommendations for designing an application that does a lot of data input or needs to take in a lot of data input? Because I don't see a lot of guidance on that, as opposed to the other way around, where we're just consuming content.
Right. So, and again, it does come down to the scenario. There are relatively few applications in the store right now that go after that problem. There are a couple, however, that are really starting to get there. So, for instance, we're starting to see some credit card terminal apps where, you know, maybe I'm at a conference, I'm selling something, I have a credit card reader plugged into my tablet, I can just go ahead and swipe. It does come down to a variety of different types of considerations. What is your API support? What's the goal of the experience? Is it more important to get people through the queue quickly, or is it more important to make sure that you have a lot of data entered in accurately? All of those decision points will drive you down a particular design path. I'd be happy to talk with you more about it, about the specifics of the situation that you're trying to solve after the event, if that's helpful. Please.
I'm wondering what kind of impact the design principles that you showed will have on the desktop apps.
You can already see that, actually. So I don't know if you've played with the consumer preview of Office 2013. So you can start to, there are all these kind of animation touches that you never would have seen in previous versions of Office. So for instance, for whatever reason, I end up living in Excel, at least in part. As the underlying data that's being visualized in a graph changes, you can actually see this little animation of the graph line moving. And what ends up being really useful about that is it lets you know where to focus. I mean, biologically, we're actually designed to focus changes in motion. So those kind of little tweaks end up being really, really useful in order to enhance the consumption of data. You'll also see things like when you're in the reader experience in Word. Again, you see that sort of fast and fluid. You see these little design touches. You even see it in PowerPoint when you're transitioning between slides or zooming in and out at different levels. I can't speak to future plans beyond that, but the really cool thing about all of this, Microsoft's like 90,000, 92,000 people or so. The fact that we're all behind this and that we're all pushing down these design principles is something that's tremendously exciting. I think you're the last question.
Hi, I'm Long from MetroTwit. Just a follow-up to Tom's question. Can you explain the difference between the Microsoft design style and the Windows 8 store app style?
They're the same. Okay. The Microsoft design, I didn't say that. The Microsoft design principles are the overall set of principles that are driving the Windows 8 store applications. So thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for your attention. And thank you for the patience while we were stumbling through some things. Enjoy the rest of your conference.